Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people stories and events in Central Iowa. I am one of your co-hosts for today, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening in.
I'm Ann Kinzel, your other co-host. Welcome.
There's lots to cover today, so let's dive right in. It's going to get sunnier as the day goes on. Expect clear skies tonight with sunny weather tomorrow and temperatures above 90 degrees. It looks like we can expect rain and storms on and off for the rest of the week, but it will be warm rain with temperatures in the high 80s and 90s. It looks like we'll have a sunny reprieve on Thursday for at least part of the day. Here's Dennis Hart with top Iowa news stories.
On this first Monday evening in June, there is plenty to report about what happened around Iowa in the past week. Des Moines and Davenport were the scenes of both violent and nonviolent protests, among the many that took place in cities across the nation following the death of George Floyd while he was in police custody in Minneapolis. In Davenport, two people were killed and a group of police officers ambushed during protests overnight. The mayor said he would ask Governor Kim Reynolds to activate the National Guard. In Des Moines last night, protesters converged on the Merle Hay Mall. Windows at the mall were broken and looting took place. Police fired tear gas. Polk County had imposed a mandatory curfew last night, and it will be in place again tonight, starting at 9. On Friday night in Des Moines, violence had broken out after what had started as a peaceful gathering. Protesters threw bricks and rocks at police cars, and officers pushed back against them. Windows in the federal courthouse, the Embassy Suites Hotel, and a tire service shop were broken. Then on Saturday, a peaceful protest march in the afternoon in Des Moines was followed by more violence at night. Demonstrators went to the state capitol. Some launched fireworks at police. Officers used tear gas and pepper spray as protesters tried to reach the Capitol building. During the course of the evening, windows were broken at the Polk County Government Building, at a parking garage, and at numerous other buildings on Court Avenue. Dozens of people were arrested. At a news conference this afternoon, the governor said the state's National Guard was ready to assist and support local law enforcement if more violent protests take place. She also said she wants to pursue changes that would lift up all Iowans and is ready to hold a dialogue about what needs to be done to make things better. On the coronavirus front last week, word that the death toll it was causing around Iowa kept going up. By this Monday afternoon, 538 state residents had died from the virus. The number of people infected also continued to rise, reaching about 19,700 by today, including 116 in Story County. Meanwhile, last week, Tyson Foods closed its Storm Lake pork processing plant temporarily, just hours after the Iowa Department of Public Health confirmed it was the site of a coronavirus outbreak that had infected 555 of its 2,500 employees. The facility will be deep cleaned and sanitized before it is reopened later this week. Word of that outbreak came one day after a health department official said that its state policy to publicly confirm outbreaks of the coronavirus at meatpacking plants or other businesses only when asked by members of the media. The public health official said the state would only confirm outbreaks at businesses if 10% of a company's employees tested positive, and then only when reporters ask about it. In another story, the Des Moines Register reported that one of the fatal victims of the coronavirus last week was an employee at the Tyson Foods plant in Waterloo, who became at least the fifth worker at the plant to die from complications of the virus. That Waterloo facility is Tyson's biggest pork processing plant. Officials said more than 1,000 of the plant's 2,800 workers had been infected with the coronavirus. There was more last week. A Des Moines nursing home administrator said he told state health authorities on May 8th that his facility had 4 confirmed coronavirus infections among residents, but that state officials did not notify the public of the outbreak until last week. That outbreak took place at Ramsey Village near Drake University. 10 coronavirus cases have now been reported there. Also last week, word that a Dallas County correctional officer said he had been fired after he reported to state officials a plan to bring back to work a jail employee who had tested positive for the coronavirus while on the job at the jail. After Dustin Robbins made that report to the state, Dallas County jail officials notified employees that the infected worker would not be returning, and the next day, Robbins was fired. And while all this was going on, Governor Reynolds loosened more restrictions on businesses and recreational activities starting today. Among the businesses that can start operating again, casinos, amusement parks, bowling alleys, pool halls, skating rinks, and arcades. They must operate at only 50% capacity. In addition, speedways and racetracks can have fans, and outdoor performance venues can hold live events starting today. Live bands and musical performances will be permitted at restaurants and bars. After the governor's reopening announcement, the Prairie Meadows Casino in Altoona said it would not reopen until June 15th. The Adventureland Amusement Park in Altoona said it would have a phased-in reopening later this week. Meanwhile, University of Iowa experts warned that the premature easing of social distancing rules could spark a surge in coronavirus cases. That report also said that encouraging the public to wear plastic face shields could substantially reduce the danger. Also last week, the governor announced that the state's moratorium on some evictions and foreclosures would end, starting midnight last Wednesday. The state launched a short-term program to help Iowans with rental or mortgage payments. And there was word that the state would take in $65 million less in revenue this year because of the coronavirus. The governor also announced how Iowa would spend about $1.25 billion in federal coronavirus relief money. $215 million would go to Iowa businesses and families, $100 million to state farmers, $124 million to communities, and much of the rest will go to the state's jobless trust fund and toward other expenses. Meanwhile, the latest jobless numbers last week showed that more than 14,500 Iowa residents had filed unemployment claims in the previous week. Across the nation, more than 2 million people filed for jobless benefits. Also last week, the Des Moines International Airport announced new safety measures after what it called slowly increasing passenger numbers over the Memorial Day weekend. The precautions include requiring employees to wear face masks, posting signs about social distancing, installing plexiglass barriers, and increasing cleaning. Travelers are encouraged to wear masks, but it is not mandatory. Passenger traffic through the airport was down nearly 96% last month. Concourse A has been closed since March, and it will reopen when, airport officials said, demand necessitates it. Still in Des Moines, word that public library patrons could start picking up books and other items by using the library's new curbside service starting today. Library staff will wear face coverings when they're delivering those items, and all books returned to the library will be quarantined for 72 hours, then cleaned with disinfectant wipes before being returned to shelves or checked out to the next patron. And there was word that the Des Moines Public School District would continue offering no-cost meals to children at 22 locations during the summer. The district has provided more than 500,000 no-cost meals since schools were closed in March to help curb the spread of the coronavirus. In another story, the Principal Financial Group, which is based in Des Moines, said it was cutting salaries for about a quarter of its global workforce because of the fallout from the coronavirus. Principal became the second large firm in Des Moines to announce pay cuts. Earlier, the Meredith Corporation, which owns magazines and TV stations, said it would temporarily reduce pay for 60% of its employees. Still on the money beat, word last week that the State Department of Agriculture would provide financial help to Iowa pork producers who faced destroying an estimated 600,000 pigs that could not be sent to pork processing plants because of coronavirus-related bottlenecks. Plants across the Midwest either closed or slowed production after workers got sick from the virus. Meanwhile, the Register reported that the Iowa Department of Public Health is working with law enforcement agencies across the state to notify responding officers of homes that may house people infected with the coronavirus. The state is sharing information about positive virus tests through dispatch centers in nearly all of Iowa's 99 counties. In another story last week, word that this summer's Hinterland Music Festival in St. Charles has been canceled because of the coronavirus. It will return next year. In other news last week, numerous tornadoes touched down in central Iowa, causing damage to businesses and property. In Johnston, the Iowa Weather Service said a tornado struck last Monday night. No one was injured, but trees and traffic signs were blown down. The tornado was rated an EF1 and had wind gusts up to 95 miles an hour. Last Tuesday, tornadoes touched down in Waukee and Dallas Center. No injuries were reported. The Waukee tornado tore through the parking lot of a car dealership. It brought down light poles and trees, tore the roof off a car wash, and broke out windows and damaged about 20 cars in a matter of 40 seconds. In both Johnston and Waukee, the twisters touched down before many people heard emergency sirens. Later in the week, the National Weather Service confirmed the sightings of 4 tornadoes in Iowa on that Tuesday. On the court beat last week, word that a competency hearing had been set for the man charged with killing a Fort Dodge pastor. 36-year-old Joshua Pendleton is accused of killing the Reverend Alan Henderson of the St. Paul Lutheran Church in Fort Dodge last October. Pendleton was evaluated at the Iowa Medical Classification Center in Coralville, where a psychiatrist concluded that he was competent to stand trial. In Des Moines, a woman was charged with animal torture after authorities said she tried to kill her cat by stabbing it with a kitchen knife, then trying to drown it. 21-year-old Rosemary K. Bulow told police that what she called her aggressive cat had bitten her while she was showering and that she stabbed the animal in self-defense. Also last week, word that the state of Iowa planned to again reject a Northeast Iowa company's request to export millions of gallons of water from the Jordan Aquifer to drought-stricken western states. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources sent a letter to the Pattison Sand Company saying the company had failed to provide enough information to determine whether its plan would be of beneficial use to the state's water. It's Pattison's third attempt to export water from Iowa. And one more story before I go. It's a follow-up to one I told you about last week, that the Des Moines Public School District had approved a plan to build a $19.5 million football and soccer stadium in partnership with Drake University. Now there's word that a petition campaign is underway in Des Moines to try to force public school officials there to hold a public vote on that plan. Stay tuned. And that is your summary of the week's news from all around Iowa on this Monday evening. I'm Dennis Hart. I'll be back here on Friday with word about what's been making news in Ames. Now, don't go away. There's much more to come right here on Local Talk. Stay tuned. There's much more to come on Local Talk.
Kevin from the CD Ghana Sounds. Welcome back to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, hosting here with Ann Kinzel. And what a weekend, right, Ann?
Yeah, things are moving fast.
Lots happened. Carter of St. Paul called it one of the most heartbreaking weeks in American history.
Yes. Well, our own Mayor John Hala issued a statement on behalf of the city of Ames on Saturday. Maybe we should start with that. In the absence of Mayor Hala reading it himself, maybe Mike Murphy, our engineer, can stand in and read it for him.
Statement from Ames Mayor John Hala, May 30th, 2020. The senseless and horrible killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis earlier this week is repulsive and extremely disturbing. The actions of the police officers were inhumane, and those responsible must be held accountable for their actions. As we struggle to protect the lives of citizens from the harmful effects of COVID-19, we should all feel collectively ashamed at this reckless disregard for human life. We are deeply grieved by what transpired. Our hearts and deepest condolences go out to his family and the entire Black community. The city of Ames remains resolutely committed to maintaining and strengthening our inclusive and welcoming city. We are not a perfect community, but we are actively engaged in trying to become a better one. Hosting the Ames Community Institute, appointing and empowering a diverse City of Ames Human Relations Commission, co-hosting the annual Symposium for Building Inclusive Workplaces, participating in NAACP-sponsored events, and recently installing the inclusive crosswalk in our downtown are tangible examples of our commitment and resolve to building and maintaining a welcoming Ames. We will not stop trying to be better. In the very near future, the City of Ames will be releasing the results of the self-initiated Ames Police Department traffic stop analysis. We took the initiative to look at how we are doing in relationship to policing and race. We look forward to sharing the results with the community and engaging in a dialogue on ways to improve. Sincerely, John A. Hala, Mayor, Ames, Iowa.
Ames residents on Saturday held a demonstration here downtown. Anne, can you tell us about it?
Yeah, I live downtown. I walked over from my house, and I'd say there was a few hundred people. It was a kind of younger than the usual Ames crowd and more diverse. There was nothing really organized. People gathered in front of the City Hall building on Clark Street, and then people walked around the block from Clark Street to Grand Avenue and around the City Hall complex twice. Passion was exhibited. A few chants were led. Lots of people wore masks in respecting COVID-19. People spoke to each other. Seemed more of a community gathering than, I would say, a protest or a demonstration.
Did you hear any comments that stay in your memory?
You know, it was hard to understand anybody clearly because lots of people were wearing their masks. And I have to admit, I was practicing social distancing myself, so I was not in the middle of the fray. The chants that were led were the ones that we're hearing across the country. Hands up. I can't breathe.
Okay, well, thank you. And about how many people do you think it was?
I'd say there were a couple hundred, but you know, I'm not a professional crowd counter. I felt that it was an enthusiastic crowd, that they were there.
Well, actually, 200 people for Ames is a crowd. Yeah.
Sure. There was a sense that people were bearing witness to something.
Thank you, Anne. Turning northward to Minneapolis, we've invited Ames native Gina Zaffirano to join us. If you're from Ames or Nevada, you may know at least one of the Zaffirano family, mm-hmm. whether from science, law, veterinary medicine circles, or even classical music in the Town and Gown series. The Zaffiranos have touched many areas of our community. Gina lives in Minneapolis now, so we reached out to her for a firsthand account of what she is seeing and experiencing. Gina, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So Gina, there are many, many stories coming from all over. Please tell us where you live and where your business is in Minneapolis.
I live in the uptown area of Minneapolis, 1 mile from where the riots took place just 2 nights ago, and just blocks from where all the destruction happened in the heart of uptown where my business lives.
What is your business, Gina?
I own a hair salon in Minneapolis. I'm a stylist.
How is your business doing?
Remarkably untouched, despite being flanked on either side and in front of and around all the businesses that were looted. We were very fortunate. We managed to board up our building before the second night of rioting and helping our neighbors who have lost their livelihoods due to the destruction that happened over the weekend.
Can you describe your neighborhood and the people who are, yes. are losing their businesses?
Yes, Lake Street is a long, many-mile corridor that stretches from an area of lakes near where I live over to St. Paul. And Lake Street specifically was targeted over the last many days when they had the looting and destruction happening. And
Gina, why was Lake Street targeted?
The Third Precinct. Where the police officers that are the police officers that were involved hail from, and from there the destructions came westward all the way down mm-hmm. towards my home in the area in uptown where I have my business.
Who are the people that have businesses around you in your neighborhood?
Very diverse community. Uptown in itself, it has become a little bit of a commercialized community. It used to be an environment where there were a lot of one-off businesses, and now that's combined with some of the larger owned organizations and businesses. And then all the way down Lake Street, as you get further towards St. Paul, are many, many, many privately owned, immigrant-owned, in fact, businesses that span the whole length of Lake Street. The sad part is that those one-offs, those businesses that are owned by the Somali community, the Hmong community, Asian American community, the Black American community, and then the white Americans, everyone is all together in this community side by side. And we have Latino, an area that serves the largely Latino population and an area that serves the largely Somalian population. And it moves forward and sort of peppered with all of these other few pop-ups that are all up and down our street.
So what kind of things have you seen, Gina, from your home, for example? What do you see outside your window?
Well, outside of my window is a very peaceful looking lake, and it's a little disturbing because literally 1 block away is where every storefront is boarded up and where stores were looted and crazy activity was happening a few days ago. We have actually, I will say, have had two quite peaceful nights in Uptown since the National Guard arrived 4 days ago, 5 days ago now. It was pretty horrifying. I have friends who live right next to my studio who were videotaping that activity on the streets. Anger that lives inside of the community has a real deep, rich history around the injustices that have been seen by and perpetrated by the police department on the Black community. And so the anger that began here last week with the horrific death of George Floyd was inspired by that anger. But what happened here in the Uptown area specifically, it was fueled by professionally organized rioters. The looting that happened, yes, there were young kids and there were people that clearly were part of this movement. But what we've seen is a real transition happening since last week to really the last 2 days. The protesting during the day is extremely peaceful, very passionate. It is calling for peace. It's calling for people to stop being destructive, because in fact, the part of this area was literally destroyed, and it is the fabric of what keeps these families living. You know, they've taken away their pharmacies, they've taken away their grocery stores, they've taken away all the auxiliary services in the immediate area for these families who don't have access to everything. The post office and bank that got looted and robbed and set on fire near the 5th precinct the other day is a mile from my home. And that is right in the heart of the community that needs all of those services the most. So what's being fueled here is this anger, but there are some outside antagonizers that are coming in. Lots of incredible stories that I've heard. The governor spoke yesterday about some of the concerns they have based on who they know is coming in. And it really isn't about the protests that are happening. These are people that are coming in for alternative reasons. And the destruction that happened there was very, very obviously organized by people who knew what they were doing, came in specifically to loot and cause destruction. So,
Gina, yeah. You know, that's a really strong statement. And yes, in the United States, we have a history of our leaders identifying, quote unquote, outsiders. And that has been used often to marginalize the demonstrations, the political activity of our minority communities. How do you know it to be true?
Without a doubt, I just have to say, there is no question that this anger and the fuel behind it has begun with the historical foundation of this marginalization of this community. What we have seen, and the firsthand accounts are these people were organized. They had and I'll just speak to an instance, and this has been reported dozens of times around the city. Last night, there was a citywide notice that went out to all of our neighbors saying that they have found incendiary devices planted in neighborhoods, because the word on the street was that people were coming in to mess up our city. Now, this is, again, if you are at the protests, which I've been over the last many days, this is not being done in the memory of George Floyd. This is being inspired and instigated and in part, I should say, grown as far as the destruction piece of what's happening in the Twin Cities has been brought in by these organizations. There are hate groups that are coming in and mixing and blending in the cities, many accounting from our governor down, that are coming in and really hiding in plain sight. And this is the challenge that has been occurring over the last two nights as the National Guard have swept in to try and quell the destruction that's been happening over the cities. And the truth is that that interaction between the very angry, very vocal protesters and the National Guards have always ended peacefully. There hasn't been anyone that has been killed. There has been no one, very little reporting of people that have been injured seriously. And in fact, it was probably on the news last night about this incident on the highway where a semi truck drove through the protesters and the people dragged out the truck driver. But there were so many reports of these kids who were there saying they were trying to protect him because he would have been killed on the spot. They swept in to gather the forces and he was being beaten up, but he was swept away by the police. They were protecting him so he could be arrested.
When we spoke earlier, you mentioned that there was suspicion that the Klan was meeting in Minneapolis. Yes. Is that really true?
Yes. Ku Klux Klan have organized in this area. There's a lot of rumor around about their intention to do destruction on the north side, which is largely from where our Black community resides. A big part of our Black community resides. And you know, sightings, they say, it's all, again, rumor that people have seen people being dropped off white cloaked. They have a gathering. They had a gathering in a park down near downtown the other night.
So a lot of people are taking advantage of the pain of 100%. Minneapolis. Absolutely. Where do you see community cohesion happening in your neighborhood?
All day long, every day. Everybody is being involved with people are blanketing the community with their Black Lives Matter support. They're funding, pouring out money, bringing supplies and food to the protest sites, helping to support and fund the community where the destruction has happened. To date, they've raised millions of dollars to support the small businesses that have been that were sources of destruction, or foundations of destruction the other day. They're pouring into the various organizations that are here to support the Black Lives Movement. People are impassioned by this, and we're impassioned by the injustice that lives in this community and with this long historical history of where there's a natural underbelly of racism in the police department.
Gina, yes. have you been demonstrating?
Yes, I have. I didn't go to the one yesterday. I unfortunately had to work on opening my businesses. But over the weekend, my husband and I have gone to the up to the site where Mr. Floyd was killed. And we stood amongst the protesters. There have been protests right down the street from my home in the version of a sit-in that I remember from the 60s and 70s, where these young, impassioned kids come and stand with hundreds and, in fact, thousands in the original at the site at 38th in Chicago to listen to one another and to implore people to stand up and expect justice to be served to these police officers.
In your observation, is there any discrepancy that you notice between how the events in Minneapolis are being presented in the media and what you're actually seeing on the street?
Local news is clearly closer to the events than a few nights ago when the crowds descended on the post office. I was watching the same thing as I flipped through the various news channels, CNN, MSNBC, and our local channels. They all had the same bird's eye view of this. What's not being reported is the daily peaceful protesting that's been done in the cities. I'm sorry.
That's a dog.
My
The dog is protesting.
Gina's muted herself as she tries to control her dog. We're speaking with Gina Zaffirano. She's an Ames native who now lives in Minneapolis, and her home and business have been in the center of the demonstrations and some of the destruction. Gina, are you back?
I am. I'm so sorry.
Okay. Well, thank you for, we have to go in a minute, but I was wondering, before you leave, could you share with us one image of what you think you'll remember from this terrible week?
Yes, I will share to you the beauty that has come about and the community that has come together to really support not only this cause, but the other day after the looting and the destruction had been done in our area by SUNUP, there were literally tens of thousands of people from around the community that descended on the area with brooms, with water, with coffee, with food, with shovels to try and participate to and help clean up this community. That is what stands out, is how much the community comes together in times like this. Minneapolis is an amazing place with amazing people who really believe that we need to come together. And I would say that in the last several days, if you didn't have an awareness of the injustice that happens in this community and the brokenness in the community, you're aware of it now. And most people that I know are pouring every resource they have into helping to support and move forward to make sure their justice is being served. It's really quite a beautiful sight to sit amongst these young, old, middle-aged, this diverse community of people who are all there to take care of one another and to have their voices heard. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, one of your hosts for this hour, together with Ann Kinzel. Welcome back. In this heartbreaking time, it's wonderful and even important to remember and connect with humanity, integrity, and positive contribution to society. So I'm really glad to be able to share with you this next interview. Last Friday, I noticed reports that a new take-home COVID-19 test had been developed at the University of Iowa based on spit. I called the office for this project, and I really lucked out because the leader, Dr. Val Sheffield, picked up the phone himself, and there was no one else in the office at the time for him to hand me off to. So he submitted to telling me about it himself. It's called Patient Sputum Self-Collection Test, or PSCS-CoV-2 for short. Dr. Sheffield is University of Iowa Molecular Genetics Chair at the Carver College of Medicine, and his breakthrough research has been crucial in developing human genetic maps. And in April, he was named to the 2020 class of the prestigious American Academy of Arts and Sciences. FDA approval is pending for the new COVID-19 test he developed, possibly within the next 2 weeks. Here is Dr. Sheffield explaining the fascinating story of his new, very hopeful development.
The COVID-19 pandemic occurred, and they were closing down laboratories here at the university so people could socially isolate. And I realized that I had everything in my laboratory that would be needed to do COVID-19 testing. I'm a molecular geneticist and medical geneticist. And so perhaps I could then just test people in my laboratory periodically. And we could then know that people were negative. And so that's how we started. However, there was a shortage of nasal swabs that are used for testing. And you talk to people that nasal swabs or oral swabs of a particular FDA-approved type are needed for the testing. Well, we could test whether that was true or not. So I'm a physician, and I have a son who's a ears, nose, and throat doctor, and he taught me how to swab myself. It's not all that comfortable, but I swab myself a bunch of times to show that the cotton swabs on the end of a wooden stick are adequate.
So it wasn't actually true?
Not in our hands, it wasn't true.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out the regular cotton swabs work as well as the FDA-approved swabs, at least in our hands. So then we said, well, why should we use swabs at all? Maybe we could just have people spit in a cup. So I started thinking about this. So when people are swabbing, they go into the nasal pharynx and they shove this probe through the nose all the way to the back of the throat. And that's where they collect cells from. Well, what if we have people just sort of, this is a little bit gross, but what if we have people just snort through their nose so they get something going to the back of their throat, and then they sort of cough, trying to cough something up from below and clear their throat to get everything into the front of their mouth as spit/sputum. And then they spit that into a container, and then we test that using the typical testing approaches that people use with the nasal swab.
Essentially, the person is snorting into their mouth and spitting out instead. Is that right?
Correct. And these are cells that have the potential to be infected with the virus. And so we did that on a bunch of uninfected people, and our data showed, yeah, we get these cells that are the cells that would be infected with the virus if people were infected.
So you can identify those particular cells, whether they're infected or not.
Correct. If they're not infected, we can still tell those cells are there by using a cellular marker, which we use as sort of a control to see if we get an adequate sample.
In those tests, you could tell that they were negative.
Yep, that's correct. So we have both positive controls that show we could detect the virus. We have a control that shows that we got the right cells and would detect the virus if it was there. We have a negative control that shows we shouldn't detect the virus if it's not there. And so all those controls. So what are we missing here at this point? Well, we're missing true cases. Well, it turns out we've been able to get some true cases, and we got human subjects approval through our university to do an experiment.
You went to people that you knew had COVID-19 and asked them whether they would try this out?
That is partially true. We only knew one such patient like that we actually knew that we could go to. But we also got assistance from a wonderful physician here at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. He could ask patients that he was taking care of whether they would be interested in enrolling in our study.
These were patients that had COVID-19.
These were patients who have COVID-19 and are being taken care of remotely at home. And then they could contact us. And we were allowed to do this based on our human subjects approval.
And a human studies approval, is that a permit? Is that what that is?
Yeah. So whenever you do a study with human subjects, there's federal regulations that you have to maintain certain principles. And each institution has what they call Internal Review Board, or IRB. And IRB boards then look at your proposal to see if it's ethical, meets certain standards, if it protects the patient, if it doesn't do any harm to the patient. And so we followed those rules to the letter. And one of the rules we followed is that although we could advertise for subjects, we could not go through patients' charts looking for subjects. So they had to contact us. And so we got some contacts, and we've tested them, run 30 different tests on different subjects at various time points of the disease. We've shown that our collection method works extremely well. We're at least 30 for 30, and we've also enrolled known negative people who were tested because they potentially could have been positive or for some other reason, and they're known negatives, and we've tested them, and we're 30 for 30 in demonstrating that they're negative.
So far the test has worked 100% of the time?
Correct. Although those numbers are relatively small. So the next step for us is to go to the Food and Drug Administration and get official approval to use our test, at least on an emergency basis, during this COVID-19 pandemic emergency, which we've tried to do since about April 1st.
How long does that usually take to get approval like that?
To get regular FDA approval for something can take months to years. With this emergency usage, you're supposed to be able to get approval within, say, a few weeks to a couple of months. And we're sort of at that boundary now.
You have already applied and you're following up with data?
We sent in our first document on April 1st. We now have all the data from the study I just described. And sitting here while you called, I'm working on the document so we can send it back to the FDA and then hopefully get approval within a week or so after that.
Wow.
Wishful thinking.
They say tests are being made and they're not being able to make them fast enough. What goes into making the test? Are you going to be able to, quote, make it? And what does that even really mean?
That's a good question. Making the test, I would say, means everything both upstream and downstream of actually performing the test. So you've got to have all the reagents that you need.
What's a reagent?
The tubes and containers. There's a liquid. Once the patient self-collects the sample, then open up a small tube and dump the whole tube into our collection container, put on the lid of the collection container, shake it up, and that solution kills the virus and it preserves the RNA, the substance from the virus that you're actually looking for. And so getting all those things together, packaged, make them deliverable, have a method where you can then get the samples in from patients in an efficient way, get them to a laboratory where they're processed, have all the equipment machinery to process them rapidly. And the downstream component of that is keeping track of all the test results and delivering the test results back to the patients and their physicians. So all that takes a lot of coordination, and those are things that we're working on now. So right now, even with this EUA approval, I could probably scale up in my laboratory to doing maybe 500 to 1,000 tests a day. The downstream component, delivering the results, would be a process that we still have to figure out.
Do you visualize then all of these tests coming to your lab, or do you visualize training other labs to begin doing this? Do you see doing this just in Iowa City, statewide, nationally? What do you see as kind of the next logical step?
Yeah, another great question. This is the question that I lose sleep about or older. In fact, I was sleepless from about 2 in the morning till 5 in the morning last night worrying about this very issue.
Yeah, you know, I felt that way when our radio station went on the air. Like, oh no.
What do I really want to do? What will I really be capable of doing? I'm a genetic disease research laboratory. I have a primary responsibility to government grants that I already have that aren't COVID-19 related. We've had debates about that in my lab. Can we really do this? And first thing I'll say, I'm not in this for any money. There's been other spit tests developed out there from Rutgers University and some company, and their solution and everything is proprietary. I want everything open source so that anybody can use it.
You're the only other lab that's done this besides Rutgers, right?
There might be another one. There's a company in Utah, I believe, that has approval. But there again, it's proprietary, and I don't think they've really delivered on the promise yet. We're still trying to decide in my lab, can we really scale up? Our goal is to get the FDA approval and then start doing some testing in our laboratory on what scale, I don't yet know, but a scale that will demonstrate that it's doable and at a larger scale than we're currently doing. And so we also intend to use it locally within our laboratory building so that when they open the labs back up fully, we could test everybody in the building to make sure that they're not infected. If they are, we send them home.
You said that you were not in this for the money. Obviously, this is a product, so to speak, that has a huge, huge market. Why don't you want to make money off of it?
Well, first of all, I don't know if I really could. I don't think there's anything that we're doing, for instance, that is patentable. So from that perspective, I don't think it would be a moneymaker, like we patent a product and then sell it or something. And I'm really not in it for the money. My life has been about doing research. I'm a physician, take care of patients. And if we can use our stuff to help with a pandemic, even in a little way or a local way, that's better than money.
That makes you a man of the hour.
Well, I don't know about that. There's a lot of good people, and, you know, I've had enough honors and things. And We know people here that came to Ames, came to Iowa City as refugees to contribute. You know, we had one here, Ignacio Ponseti, who died a few years ago. He invented this club foot treatment that is really the way to treat club feet in children. And, you know, he should have been famous for it and made a lot of money for it, but that wasn't his goal. His goal was to treat club feet in children. When you have role models like that, well, you see, this is why also we're not in it for the money. But some of the frustrating things why I wanted to get into this is that, for example, we heard that in Cedar Rapids there were elderly care facilities, you know, residential care facilities, that were having relatively large outbreaks of their staff and residents, and they weren't getting tested fast enough. And I've got a 93-year-old mother-in-law that lives in such a nice residence here in Iowa City, where they had two staff members test positive. Fortunately, no one in that facility has gotten sick. But I asked myself, why isn't somebody testing everybody in such situations so they can stop the progression of the virus in such facilities? So we potentially hope to target specific places and being able to help.
Can I ask you one more thing? Your lab is really a genetic lab, as you said, for blindness.
Yeah.
What is it about your lab that made it compatible with testing for COVID?
Yeah, it's the basic molecular techniques and equipment. So we do lots of things where we get human patients and get a sample. In most cases, it's a sample of their blood, but we could also do it with spit, because that contains cells, that contains DNA. And then we can test the DNA we get from those cells from patients for mutations in various genes using very similar methods and equipment as you use to test for the virus. This virus is a little bit different in that its genetic material is not DNA, but it's RNA. But you can get the virus and test the RNA in a very similar way as you would test DNA.
So it's the genetic mutation that is the red flag that you see when you look at it? Am I making sense?
When we're checking for diseases in people, a specific genetic disease that we work on that causes blindness, we get a sample of their DNA by getting a blood sample or a saliva sample, and we can check to see if that given patient has a mutation in it that they may have inherited that will cause them to go blind. And so the methods used to detect that mutation in a patient are very similar to the techniques that we would use to detect the virus in the patient's sample.
So you're saying the virus shows up in the RNA?
The virus is an RNA. So the genetic material of the virus is an RNA. We can detect using our same methods that we would use to detect a mutation in DNA from a patient. We can detect if the viral RNA is present in the patient's cells that we collect from their saliva.
So the RNA comes from the virus.
The RNA that we're looking for comes from the virus.
From the virus.
Yeah, the specific RNA.
What is RNA?
Boy, you want me to teach some basic
I know, knowledge. I'm sorry. If I'm going too far, stop me. But
well, so DNA, which most people have heard of, deoxyribonucleic acid, is what's found in our chromosomes and genes. And the genes within our chromosomes are the template off of which another molecule is made called RNA. And RNA is then used as a template to make proteins. And proteins are what we're made of, all different types of proteins. So we need all different types of genes to make all different types of RNA to make all different types of proteins, which makes us. And the virus has a small genome, if you will, which consists of RNA. And the virus gets into the human cells, and its RNA starts making proteins that are coded by that RNA, which causes the virus to be able to replicate and burst out of the cells and go to other cells, which make us sick, having the virus around.
So the virus is trying to make protein for itself.
The virus is trying to replicate itself, and in doing that, it needs to make its RNA to make specific viral protein.
So it has its own RNA, and then it comes and it...
And it uses it to make its proteins.
Got it.
Which it does inside of human cells, which is bad for those human cells, and that process make us sick. Some people sicker than others for reasons we don't quite understand.
Got it. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Ursula.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to the voice of Dr. Val Sheffield, University of Iowa Molecular Genetics Chair in the Carver College of Medicine, who has played a crucial role in developing human genetics maps and has just completed creating a new COVID-19 take-home test that is based on spit, with the hopes that he will soon be able to make tests more readily and more affordably available. When speaking with Dr. Sheffield, I also ask him another question that I think about, which was, how difficult is it for him to tell people when they test positive for COVID-19? And he said, well, you know, he's a doctor, and so he's very accustomed to giving people bad news about their health. He said there's ways to do it. And I said, so what is the secret of being able to break bad news? His answer was that when you tell people bad news, you should never preclude hope. You should always leave hope. And on that note, Thanks to Dr. Sheffield for that interview and taking so much time for KHOI. And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community COVID-19 Pivotal Radio. We've been your hosts, Ann Kinzel and Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening. Local Talk was engineered by Mike Murphy.
Thank you for spending the hour with us today. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. You can hear a recording of this show later today online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. Also, remember that KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org. Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. You also heard music from the CD, Ghana Sounds. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting KHOI, and we'll see you again on the radio. Thank you.